This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Meryl Streep sings really badly in her new film Florence Foster Jenkins. And I mean that as a compliment, because the role she's playing is based on the life of an heiress and socialite who devoted her life to music as a philanthropist and performer. Florence Foster Jenkins' singing was wildly off-key, squeaky and screechy, but she mostly sang in front of audiences of sympathetic friends. When she ventured outside of that, she developed a cult following for being unintentionally hilarious. Here's a recording of the real Florence Foster Jenkins. You get the point. The movie Florence Foster Jenkins is set in New York in the mid-1940s. Hugh Grant plays Foster's common-law husband, a failed actor who has made a profession out of protecting her from her critics and from reality. He loves her, but not in a husbandly way. Simon Helberg plays the pianist who wins the audition to be her accompanist and is shocked when he first hears her sing. The movie was directed by Stephen Frears. Here's Meryl Streep, accompanied by Simon Helberg, in a scene from the film in which they're performing for a small, private audience.
Oh, noble sir, how far you are, you're really not discreet. Therefore, my advice is that you look twice when judging those you meet. My little white hand so fine, my foot with its contour divine, my speech so disarming, my waistline so slim and charming. No lady's maid could be full so much grace, you see. No lady's maid could be full so much grace, you see.
Meryl Streep, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, I first heard Florence Foster Jenkins years ago, and I always wondered, like, how is it possible that she actually thought she sang well? That's a question I assume you had to answer for yourself, because you're living in her delusion that she's a wonderful singer. So how did you answer that for yourself?
Well, I think we all think we sound really good in the shower, where there's that nice reverb.
And the water's drowning you out.
And the water's drowning you out. And there is some liberation in the freedom of being totally alone and really going for it. You know, I did hear a recording, I believe it was Irving Berlin, playing and singing along to his own music. And the piano playing was wonderful. The singing, however, was not. It was circling the notes that we knew presumably were in his head, but he wasn't hitting the pitches. I mean, it was sort of amazing. He meandered around the pitches. And I kept thinking, but he's such a genius. He must know what it should sound like. And so maybe this was part of Florence's inability to hear herself. Or there could be because she had physical challenges that involved tinnitus, you know, this thing in your ear because she was ill. But who knows? Who knows what she heard? I do know that we have delusions about ourselves and what we sound like.
But other people played along with it. Do you think that that's because she had money? That these were her friends and people who were the beneficiaries of her philanthropy, so they were very ingratiating?
Oh, certainly there were people who cultivated friendships with her for the checks that they might receive. She was extremely generous to arts organizations in the city, and she did underwrite Toscanini's many concerts in Carnegie Hall. And other organizations for indigent musicians. She gave instruments to children. On the other hand, there was something else, I think, compelling about the way that she attacked the arias that she attempted. And she really had a big ambition. She tried the very most difficult pieces there are in the coloratura canon. So I think there had to be some other reason. And certainly in our film, we take that position that there was something about the joy and the pure desire to give this thing that she so loved, this music, to people and for them to receive it. And that was something that drew people to her.
One thing I don't need advice about is how to sing badly. Nevertheless, I'm really interested in learning how you did it. First of all, I'd like to know, did you have to learn the songs for real before you could learn how to kind of butcher them?
Oh, sure. Exactly. That's exactly it. And I was freaking out. I was making a rock and roll movie and sort of grinding my voice into oblivion, singing Tom Petty and everything. And
this is while you were making Ricky and the Flash?
Making Ricky and the Flash. So I was in that film with Audra McDonald, whom I know a little bit. And I was whining about having to learn 9 very difficult arias. She said, you have to go to Arthur Levy. Arthur Levy, first of all, he's my coach. He's divine. He understands bel canto singing. And 2, he has a sense of humor. And it was great. He taught me these arias straight. I learned to sing them as well as I possibly could. And then I screwed around with them. And that really only started when Simon and I got together, because even though we had been assured that we would record all the music first, which is what you normally do in a musical, you record first, and we went into Abbey Road Studios, we recorded all 9 of these songs in their entirety, and because it makes it easier to edit if you have a consistent version that you sing to on set. And then we got to work the first day, and Stephen said, let's do it live. Let's just go for it. So we did. We sang and played live.
So you learned to sing the songs as well as you could before learning how to do them really badly.
Yes.
Since you studied with a great teacher for this film, and you took singing lessons when you were young, in your early teens, I think, you studied opera. Mm-hmm. So did all those lessons help you diagnose what Florence Foster Jenkins was doing wrong, enable you to hear what she was doing wrong well enough so that you could make those same things go wrong with your voice?
You know, what pulled me to her was not so much where she went wrong as how much of it she got right. She came so close in moments. And I think that's sort of what held the audience rapt attention, was that she almost got there until the moment when it went wildly off the rails. Do you know what I mean? And So I could hear in the recordings of her voice her excitement. Do you know what I mean? It was her breathlessness and her breathing in the absolute wrong places to achieve the note that she was so hopeful that she'd get at the end of a phrase. It was the specificity of where she went wrong, married to the desire that you could hear in it, and the will and the innocence. There's something just gorgeous in it that made it more of an acting thing than a technical thing. Do you know what I mean?
Nevertheless, I want more of a diagnosis of what what she did wrong and how you tried to achieve that yourself.
There was nothing consistent about it. She wasn't always a half tone under the note. Sometimes she'd be dead on it, and the particular sort of fluty sound of her voice, and it's we always aim for a rounded tone when we're singing. And she was totally unconcerned with that. She was concerned with being right on the thing and just absolutely getting it right. And then she'd go off. And when she'd go off, you can see her gathering the reins, pulling the horses back, and launching bravely into the next part, even if she forgets the words. So sometimes she just kind of chew on the syllables. Since she got back into it, reminded me of hearing a kid singing and then they forget the words, or they never really learned the words, but they just go through the parts that they don't really understand. There were moments of that. And then there were moments where she was absolutely dead accurate. In some parts of The Queen of the Night, the most difficult passages, you can almost feel the celebration in the fact that she achieved each one of these notes. She had an F above high C, which is stratospheric, and I never could get above an E flat. So I actually couldn't sing as well as Florence Foster Jenkins.
Well, reaching that note is not the mark of what good singing is.
No, it's not.
Purely technical.
But it's I don't know. I didn't parse it that way. I mean, I actually didn't approach it to replicate exactly what she did. We operated in the spirit of where she gobbled.
Right.
Yeah, that's the word.
Okay, so I want to play some of you singing the Queen of the Night aria from Mozart's Magic Flute. But before we hear that, tell us why this aria is so important.
Tell children to leave the room. it's important because this was the end of a particularly harrowing part of her debut at Carnegie, which was also her farewell performance at Carnegie Hall. It comes after a particularly harrowing beginning, which she gets through, and there's something triumphant about how she lives and feels through this aria, the queen railing at heaven.
So here is Meryl Streep as Florence Foster Jenkins from the soundtrack of the new film Florence Foster Jenkins. Here you go. Wow.
That's enough, really.
How does it feel when you listen back to it?
Oh, I'm not really objective. By the end of the movie, I thought I sounded really good, so.
Living in that delusion.
Yeah.
Well, you sounded really good as her. So the coloratura part, you sound like a squeak toy on some of that. Do you know?
Yeah.
And I can't help but wonder, like, how did you protect your voice singing improperly like that?
I know. I had convinced Stephen.
Stephen Frears, the director.
Stephen Frears, the director, because he was being very protective of my voice. And I said, yeah, but let's shoot the audience first because they don't know what they're going to hear. They could, you know, they're all sort of 500 unsuspecting Londoners came in all dressed up, the extras, and they didn't know what they were going to hear. So we just sort of, Simon and I just gave them a concert, and they had five cameras on them, and all those reactions in the audience are just gold. They're just exactly what you want. And then I really regretted it, because once we'd exhausted the aria, I mean, I'd done it like four or five times for them, all the arias of the concert. Then they turned around on me, and I sounded like Kermit, you know.
My voice was raw.
But we pulled it together, and I really regretted that we had the live performance, that Stephen insisted on that, because it's more ragged than it should be.
I'm sure you've seen on the internet, there are several pages of just links to movies where you've sung, like in Heartburn, when you're with Jack Nicholson, you're both eating pizza, and he says, like, let's sing every song with baby in the title. So you sing all these songs with baby in the title. And then in Silkwood, you sing a lullaby, I think. They're just all like little bits and pieces where it's not a musical, but you happen to sing. So we all assume that that's because, Meryl Streep can sing, so like, let's work in just a little way when we get her to sing a little bit. Is that how it happens?
You know, if that were the case, they would have really had Cher sing in Silkwood. more obviously. I think it was just stuff that was in the script. You know, Nora Ephron and Alice Arlen wrote Silkwood, and they wrote those things in. So I haven't really sung as myself any time, I don't think.
Do you know who you are singing as yourself? Because I've only seen you sing in character.
And yes,
when you're in like a rock musical, you know, Ricky and the Flash, and in Postcards from the Edge, you're singing more. Well, there's a country and western song, and then there's a more, you know.
Oh, yeah, and Postcards, yeah.
Yeah, and then in Prairie Home Companion, it's more like folk country.
More country, yeah.
So, like, I don't know, I don't have a sense of, like, if I said, and tonight, Meryl Streep in concert, I don't know what you'd sing or how you'd sound.
Well, it would be a varied show. I don't know. I don't really... I don't.
Is that a warm up
really,
exercise?
I have it's like. One Christmas I remember when I was 12, I was in a concert and someone was there and told my parents that they should really, it was a shame not to train that voice. After the Christmas concert, my mother decided to, in front of the whole family, the gathered family, including my formidable grandmother, Mamie, she said, Meryl sang O Holy Night in French, and Meryl, sing it now. And if I ever have to play a person who is overcome with fear and terror, I go back to that moment, because I hadn't had any trouble singing in the Christmas concert. But standing in the living room in front of my whole family, all my, you know, annoying brothers and my cousins and everybody looking at me, I just went crazy. I just was like shaking. I remember shaking. I thought, I don't like this feeling. And I don't like that feeling. So I think I'm not a natural performer. I think I'm an actor.
Well, getting back to music, I want to play something from Postcards from the Edge, which was made in 1990, directed by the now late Mike Nichols, based on a book by...
Carrie Fisher.
By Carrie Fisher, yes. And it's kind of biographical. And so you've been in rehab, you're kind of trying to figure out your life in this, your character. And your mother, who is modeled on Carrie Fisher's mother, Debbie Reynolds, is a singer and performer who was big in musicals in the 50s and 60s. You've been living with her. There's a party at her place, and you're asked to sing. So you go up to, I forget if it's a guitarist or pianist, and you start working it out with him. And the song is You Don't Know Me. So here is Meryl Streep from Postcards from the Edge.
You know that... Okay. You give your hand to me, that Ray Charles tune, and then you say hello.
Yeah, keep going.
And I can hardly speak. Can hardly sing. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell that you think you know me well.
Sweet song.
Well, you don't know me. No, you don't know the one who dreams of you at night, longs to kiss your lips, longs to hold you tight. To you I'm just a friend, and that's all that I've ever been. But you don't know me.
I don't know the bridge.
That's Meryl Streep singing in the film Postcards from the Edge. Did you sing that as yourself? Like, how deep were you in character for that?
No, I mean, well, it's funny that I spoke about that moment in my grandmother's house because it was very similar. Shirley MacLaine plays my mother. She makes me do this, and I've just gotten out of rehab, and my character is very tender and raw. And she kind of more or less forces me to get up in front of all these people and sing. So it's very deflected and sort of a lot of excuses built into singing something that actually means something. And still, it's almost this little tiny voice from somewhere deep inside, and then her mother gets up and sings Stephen Sondheim's I'm Still Here,
right.
And throws her legs up on the piano and the red sequin dress, and it just blows her daughter out of the water once again. So, yes, it's singing in character. It's singing in character.
You know how you were saying earlier that when your family asked you to sing, you got, like, really nervous and scared when you were a kid?
Yeah.
So when you're performing now, does that still happen? Or are you, like, over that? 'Cause
it still happens. Now I think it happens more when I have to be Meryl Streep, and that it just seems like too big of a thing for anybody to be. So I get nervous feeling I have to fill out the parameters of this colossus or something, you know, in public appearances or something.
Right, but like fulfill impossible expectations.
Yeah, yes, exactly. But but in acting is it's just a kind of another kind of transport for me. It's a playground. I relate to Florence, I think, in that way.
Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of abandon that I see in her that I chase as an actor. She seems to, without a self-editing muscle, she seems to really be enveloped in the joy of making music.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today. Congratulations on the new film.
Thank you.
It's just a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Terry.
Meryl Streep stars in the new movie Florence Foster Jenkins. And now our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, has a timely suspense novel to recommend about the serious world of female gymnastics. Here's her review of You Will Know Me by Megan Abbott.
As always, gymnastics is one of the most watched events at this year's Summer Olympics. There's something about the tension between those ripped yet childlike bodies of so many of the young female gymnasts and the impossibly daring feats they perform on the floor and balance beam that makes the sport transfixing. And for every gymnastics event that takes place in the spotlight, another parallel event is taking place in the stands. There, the families of the young athletes sit, their faces strained with anxiety and, of course, pride. Imagine the years of sacrifice that have gone into making that brief Olympic moment possible. The second mortgages to finance private coaching, the drives to daily workouts, the weekends forfeited to an endless round of out-of-town competitions. But that's no matter. For parents to witness their child compete at the Olympics would be worth almost anything, wouldn't it? Perhaps, as Megan Abbott suggests in her terrific new psychological suspense novel, even murder would be a small price to pay for lasting Olympic greatness. Abbott's new novel, called You Will Know Me, is itself worthy of the gold. In it, she takes readers deep into the intense, vacuum-sealed world of young female gymnasts and their parents. It's a masterful thriller that also offers an eerily precise portrait of the way teenage and parental cliques operate. The novel's central characters, Katie and Eric Knox, have overextended themselves financially and emotionally to support their 15-year-old daughter, Devin. Ever since Devin was 3, gymnastics has been the mighty spine of everything for them. Now Devin is on the brink of qualifying for the Olympics under the expert tutelage of Coach Teddy, the gymnast whisperer, who presides over Bell Star's gym, which has become the Knox's universe. The gym's booster parties constitute the extent of their social life. The other girls' parents are their only friends, or sort of, because Devin, after all, is the sun, and the other girls merely her satellites. One fateful night, however, everything threatens to collapse. A young man named Ryan, who works at the gym, is found dead, a victim of an apparent hit and run. Perhaps it wasn't smart of him to walk alone on a dark country road. Perhaps it also wasn't smart of him to be so cheerfully oblivious to the fierce competitive currents swirling around that gym. It's Abbott's psychological smarts that make You Will Know Me such a standout. Most of this thriller is narrated from the point of view of Devin's harried mom, Katie. At first, Katie seems like the kind of mom you'd want to sit next to at a gymnastics meet, sharing power bars and gossip. But as Devin's Olympic hopes are threatened, we readers start to realize that a tiger mom lurks beneath Katie's bright smile. Similarly, Abbott manipulates our view of Devin, whom the other girls call Ice Eyes, because she's so opaque and unflappable. Throughout most of the novel, Abbott emphasizes Devin's star status and power as a gymnast, which is why this scene towards the end, where Katie enters Devin's high school classroom, is so startling. It had been a while, more than a while, since Katie had seen Devin among so many other girls her age, non-gym girls. None of them looked anything like Devin. When had they all developed these bodies, these absurdly luxuriant breasts stretched beneath straining t-shirts? These were women, or close enough. And a few feet apart from them, in her quiet corner, her pencil moving, sat her tiny Herculean daughter, stallion thighs stretched against the denim of her jeans, her face wan and small. Abbott commands our attention with a plot that somersaults and backflips whenever a safe landing seems in sight. But what's even more ingenious is how artfully her novel draws us readers into that closed world of the Bell Star's gym. Chapter by chapter, we come to understand and share Katie and Eric's parental obsession with Devin's athletic career. You Will Know Me is a terrific accompaniment to this summer's Olympic frenzy. It's an all-around winner.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed You Will Know Me by Megan Abbott. Our next guest, Colson Whitehead, isn't used to his books getting quite the attention he's getting for his new novel, The Underground Railroad. It's the new selection for Oprah's Book Club. Sunday, the New York Times published a lengthy excerpt in a special standalone section. The Underground Railroad is about a slave named Cora who grows up on a Georgia plantation and at the age of 15 escapes through the Underground Railroad. This Underground Railroad, in Whitehead's reimagining, is literally a railroad with underground tracks and locomotives making stops in different states. That's one of the many liberties Colson takes with the actual past. Reviewing the book in the New York Times, Michiko Kakutani described it as a potent, almost hallucinatory novel that leaves the reader with a devastating understanding of the terrible human costs of slavery. Whitehead has told a story essential to our understanding of the American past and the American present. Colson Whitehead previously joined us on Fresh Air to talk about his novel Zone One, about a zombie plague. He loves science fiction. And his memoir, The Noble Hustle, about high-stakes poker. His new novel, The Underground Railroad, begins with a prologue of sorts, telling the story of Cora's grandmother, Ajari, who was kidnapped from her African village and shipped to America to become a slave. Colson Whitehead, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from The Underground Railroad.
Sounds good. This is the first page. The first time Caesar approached Cora about running north, she said no. This was her grandmother talking. Cora's grandmother had never seen the ocean before that bright afternoon in the port of Ouida, and the water dazzled after her time in the fort's dungeon. The dungeon stored them until the ships arrived. Dahomian raiders kidnapped the men first, then returned to her village the next moon for the women and children, marching them in chains to the sea, two by two. As she stared into the black doorway, Ajari thought she'd be reunited with her father down there in the dark. The survivors from her village told her that when her father couldn't keep the pace of the long march, the slavers stove in his head and left his body by the trail. Her mother had died years before. Cora's grandmother was sold a few times on the trek to the fort, passed between slavers for cowrie shells and glass beads. It was hard to say how much they paid for her in Ouida, as she was part of a bulk purchase. 88 human souls for 60 crates of rum and gunpowder, the price arrived upon after the standard haggling in Coast English. Able-bodied men and childbearing women fetched more than juveniles, making an individual accounting difficult. The ship, called the Nanny, was out of Liverpool and had made two previous stops along the Gold Coast. The captain staggered his purchases rather than find himself with a cargo of singular culture and disposition. Who knew what brand of mutiny his captives might cook up if they shared a common tongue? This was the ship's final port of call before they crossed the Atlantic. Two yellow-haired sailors rowed Ajari out to the ship, humming, white skin like bone.
That's from the opening of Colson Whitehead's new novel, The Underground Railroad. Why did you want to write a novel about slavery and escaped slaves? Had something happened in your life that made you want to immerse yourself in that history?
Actually, I was pretty reluctant to immerse myself into that history. It took 16 years for me to finish the book. I first had the idea in the year 2000, and I was finishing up a long book called John Henry Days, which had a lot of research. And I was just sort of, you know, getting up from a nap or something and thought, you know, what if the Underground Railroad was an actual railroad? You know, I think when you're a kid and you first hear about it in school or whatever, you imagine a literal subway beneath the earth. And then you find out that it's not a literal subway and you get a bit upset. And so the book took off from that childhood notion. And that's a premise, not that much of a story. So I kept thinking about it. And I thought, well, what if every state our hero went through as he or she ran north was a different state of American possibility. So Georgia has one sort of take on America, and North Carolina, sort of like Gulliver's Travels. The book is rebooting every time the person goes to a different state. And it seemed like a cool idea. It also seemed very daunting. I didn't want to delve into slavery. It seemed like a very huge topic for me at the time. I wasn't sure if I was up for writing it in terms of my talent, I guess. I figured if I waited, I might become a better writer. And if I waited and became a more mature person, I might be able to actually take it on. So there was no one thing that made me want to do it, and many factors that made me not want to take it on for all those years.
So one of the stops Cora, the escaped slave, goes to on the Underground Railroad is South Carolina, where they think of themselves as very progressive. Why do they think of themselves that way?
Well, you know, they've thought about the problem of slavery and how to fix it. And so they're buying slaves from slave owners and freeing them and giving them jobs and housing and schooling and giving them a fresh start. You know, the first chapter of the book is a hopefully realistic portrayal of a plantation in Georgia, and it's the kind of plantation we recognize from history and pop culture. And then she takes the Underground Railroad and emerges in South Carolina, where there is this seemingly progressive government devoted to black uplift and various social programs. But of course, because it's the start of the book, things don't turn out that great. And there's a sinister purpose behind all of these progressive programs they're giving to the colored folk who've come to South Carolina.
And you've based some of this on actual history. I mean, without giving away too much, there's a medical program that seems like it would be very helpful, but they're really conducting a syphilis study and using black people as guinea pigs.
Yeah, I think, you know, once I made the choice to make a literal Underground Railroad, you know, it freed me up to play with time a bit more. And so in general, you know, the technology, culture, and speech is from the year 1850. That was my sort of mental cutoff for technology and slang. But it allowed me to bring in things that didn't happen in 1850, skyscrapers, aspects of the eugenics movement, forced sterilization, and the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. And it's all presented sort of matter-of-factly.
Yeah, can I quote something from the book about the forced sterilization program? One of the characters says, "America has imported and bred so many Africans that in many states the whites are outnumbered. For that reason alone, emancipation is impossible. With strategic sterilization, first the women, but both sexes in time, we could free them from bondage without fear that they'd butcher us in our sleep."
Yeah, I mean, that's taken, part of that is from late 19th century eugenics literature, and then taken from early 19th century racist literature, people who, you know, perhaps rightly were afraid that if black people were freed, they would exact retribution. You know, they're outnumbered, they've been breeding slaves, and then you wake up one day and like, actually, we're outnumbered by these people that we torture, brutalize, and subjugate. So not sticking to the facts, it allowed me to combine different forms of racial hysteria.
In South Carolina, there's something called the Museum of Natural Wonders that Cora, the escaped slave, ends up working in. And it's described to her as having a focus on American history. And one of the people who runs it says, "The museum permits people to see the rest of the country and to see its people, people like you." And why don't you describe what some of the rooms in this museum are?
Sure. Cora is a living exhibit, and so she stands in a display case all day, along with two other former slaves, and they rotate through these different tableaus. One is Scenes from Darkest Africa, and that's a seemingly realistic depiction of life back in the motherland. And so there's a little hut and some gourds and some spears, and they pretend to interact with them. There's a scene on a slave ship where Cora is sort of happily swabbing and not below decks in chains as she would have been. And there's life on a plantation where she's happily sewing and not being whipped in the fields and otherwise abused by a master. And so the museum presents this false sanitized version of American life for the nice white people of South Carolina who come to see it.
You've been describing her life in South Carolina. When she gets back on the Underground Railroad and gets off on the next stop, it's North Carolina, which is a real contrast to South Carolina. Would you describe a little bit about the laws in North Carolina?
North Carolina, as she discovers, doesn't put up a false front of its, you know, true intent. In order to solve the problem of slavery, they've outlawed all black people. And so if you have dark skin and you're found in North Carolina, you can be lynched, executed. And so it's a white separatist supremacist state, much in the way that towns in Oregon, when they were being settled, were settled on a white separatist supremacist ideal. So again, it's taking, you know, aspects of American history and then taking them to a certain extreme. That section in North Carolina was inspired by one of the more better-known slave narratives, Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. And she was in North Carolina and fled her abusive master who had sexual designs upon her and hid 7 years in an attic until she could be get passage out of town. So Cora is trapped in an attic that overlooks the town park, and every Friday there's a happy lynching festival where they execute the latest black person who's been caught up in the in their program of genocide. That's a bit of a I guess if I put it that way, it sounds a bit bleak.
A bit? Perhaps. Well, you know, toward the end of the book, one of the characters, you know, they're talking about what to do and how to help black people and who can be helped and who maybe can't be helped, so let's not spend the energy trying to save them. And so one character says, we're not all going to make it. Some of us are too far gone. Slavery has twisted their minds, an imp filling their minds with foul ideas. They've given themselves over to whiskey and its false comforts, to hopelessness and its constant devils, those who will not, cannot respect themselves. It's too late for them. So it's this debate. It's like, is it too late for someone? And a character says, we can't save everyone, but that doesn't mean we can't try. Here's one delusion, that we can escape slavery. We can't. Its scars will never fade. And to me, like, that's what the book is really about, how the scars of slavery will never fade.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a debate that was going on in the 1800s. How do we create a program of black uplift? Some of us have been so damaged by slavery that they'll never be teachers, doctors. Who can we save? And there are echoes in that argument, obviously, now. I mean, people say people are addicted to crack, they're on welfare, you know, they're too far gone to be saved. And conceiving the book, it didn't take a lot of energy to find parallels for the language of the slave problem and the inner city problem. All those debates still are going on in different, you know, with different sort of coded language. But yes, the legacy of slavery reverberates in Jim Crow laws, separate but equal, institutionalized racism, the incarceration state, all the things that the people in the Underground Railroad are struggling with have parallels, echoes today. When I learned about slave patrollers in the early 1800s were the de facto police force in the South, and it was their job to catch runaway slaves and make sure that any black person walking down the street had their papers, and they could stop, detain any black person, demand to see their papers, and of course, if you were didn't have license to move around freely, you're beaten, taken back to your master, jailed, and it was just an early version of stop and frisk. Any white person with the slightest authority could demand to see the bona fides of any black person walking around, and of course, growing up in the city, I'm acquainted with stop and frisk, with being pulled over by cops, with being handcuffed and questioned as I'm going about my business. Obviously not every day, but it's a common occurrence for most black people in America. So we have a new name for it, stop and frisk. And 200 years ago, it was law and order.
When were you handcuffed?
I was in high school, and I was in a grocery store, and a policeman came up to me and said, put your hands behind your back. And I was taken out to the police car, and a white woman had been mugged a few blocks away. And I guess I was the only black teenager, or probably the first black teenager the police had found. And she was like, that's not him. And they let me go.
What did you say to the police?
Well, I'd been prepared for my father, who had told me that, you know, whenever I leave the house, I'm a target. And if I'm in the wrong neighborhood, I can be lynched. You don't call it lynching, but, you know, in the 80s, there were various cases of young black men wandering to the wrong neighborhood in Brooklyn and getting beaten or killed. So, you know, I'd been prepared by my father. You know, that's the narrative of black life. But that was the first time I'd had such a true introduction to it, which is, you know, being handcuffed and interrogated by cops.
Did your parents register a formal complaint?
When I told my father like a week later, he was like, you didn't get their badge number? And I was like, it didn't occur to me. And he was, you know, it was a confirmation of his fear that he had each time I left the house anyway. And then also to know that there was no opportunity of redress upset him. And I was sort of, you know, I can do that. I actually have the agency to ask for a badge number. I'm not sure if they tell you if you ask. So, you know, it made my 16-year-old head spin.
So your book is the selection for the Oprah Book Club, which is a pretty big deal. I think you found out about this in April, but you weren't allowed to say anything because it wasn't public yet until, like, very recently. Was that a hard secret to keep?
Yeah, it was a crippling. You know, people just say, you know, when's your book coming out? And I'm September, knowing that it's August. I told my wife, and you know, and that was about it. And so, on the one hand, I like to, you know, I sort of have a pessimistic view of things. And it's sort of made me not able to keep my usual level of depression going. Because I was, and I still am, in a pretty good mood about Oprah, you know, picking it. You know, I mean, obviously, she just reaches a huge audience, and people who have no interest in reading a book about elevator inspectors or zombies or poker or black kids growing up in the 80s will come to the book now because
the subjects of your previous book, in case anybody missed that.
And I'm not sure why people wouldn't want to pick up a book about elevator inspectors, but having Oprah testify for the book was really great.
Well, Colson Whitehead, thank you so much for talking with us and coming back to Fresh Air.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Colson Whitehead's new novel is called The Underground Railroad. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.